It's very difficult to change Bitcoin. Like, it tends to take many years to make significant changes to Bitcoin. There is actually reason to believe that we may be past the point at which it's possible to make significant changes to Bitcoin. And so I think that, since we are relatively sure that on a long enough time frame this is going to become a problem, we might as well start working on solutions for it now. We need to get ahead of the curve. We need to have, a solution decided upon so that we can roll it out and people can start to migrate their coins. Because, like, even once we get all the way to a point where a quantum resistant signature scheme is agreed upon, it will then still take many years for all of the ecosystem to upgrade and many years for everyone to move their coins.
Hey guys, welcome back to the channel. Today I'm here with co-founder and CTO of Casa HODL, Jameson. How you doing, man?
All right, just got back from El Salvador.
Why Bitcoin, man? Why people should buy Bitcoin?
Well, that's a bit of a loaded question. I don't tell people to buy Bitcoin. And really, when people ask me if they should buy Bitcoin, my answer is, if you have to ask that question, then the answer is no. If you're not sure whether or not you should be acquiring Bitcoin, then what you should be doing is educating yourself. And that's one of the things that I do. I run a website with thousands of links to educational resources that will hopefully allow anyone who's willing to put in the time to convince themselves that they should be interested in this and that it is a potential exit from the fiat system that we are trapped in by default.
ETFs have come in last year in January, and 5% of the total supply is in the hands of BlackRock and all the other guys, as I call it. Are you worried? Should we worry about them owning so much Bitcoin? What do you think?
I worry about it in terms of systemic risk to the system. This is a tricky thing to talk about because it's very hard to quantify. There's no specific amount of Bitcoin at which some threshold gets reached at which we should all suddenly be running around like there's a crisis. 5% in the hands of a few large entities is not great, but I'd be far more worried if it was 50%. This really comes down to governance and to risk of potential edge cases. So think of it like 6102 attacks, orders by nation states saying, we're coming in and we're seizing all of this. When a large amount of the Bitcoin is in a few well-known hands, regulated financial providers, it becomes very, very easy for a government to, legally or otherwise, come in and put pressure on them and try to dictate what happens to those assets. From a governance perspective, if we're talking about like the future of the Bitcoin protocol, then this starts to become a little worrying because if you read through the ETF prospectus for pretty much any of the ETFs, they tend to reserve the right to effectively decide in the case of a protocol fork, which fork is the real Bitcoin. So, one of the major things around forking governance is that, there's no vote, but people, at least people who self-custody, essentially have the right to vote with their feet, to sell one side of the fork and potentially buy another side of the fork to, economically express which version of the protocol they're more interested in. So if all of a sudden a huge swath of Bitcoin is no longer allowed to be used in that manner by the quote unquote owners of the coins, and rather they're essentially ceding their vote, if you will, their economic vote to large regulated institutional providers, then you can easily see how that could result in unintended consequences and perhaps future evolution or lack of evolution of the protocol.
I'm sure you've seen when BlackRock released a video about their kind of advertisement for Bitcoin. There was like an asterisk in the end saying 21 million kind of is not the cap kind of thing. So I don't know why they've done it. I don't know if it was a legal thing, but it was kind of concerning to see, because technically 21 million, I mean, unless we fork into something else, like you said, yeah, that's kind of the cap. That's kind of the thing why we buy Bitcoin. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that was, you know, having to get permission from lawyers to say certain things that if you think about, you know, any aspect of Bitcoin is not really guaranteed to remain that way in perpetuity from a technical perspective. But, you know, the reason anyone who understands the protocol and the game theory well enough understands that there's a lot of things that are practically unchangeable simply because of how difficult it is to make decisions where you're getting the rest of the network to agree to a change.
Are you expecting an in-kind at some point coming in? Because so far what happens, for those of you guys watching and listening, if you don't know, when you buy an ETF, you're basically allowing a custodian, a third party, to have your Bitcoin on your behalf. And when you sell them, well, they technically don't have to sell their Bitcoin, right? They can just give you fiat.
I mean, it sounds like some of them are starting to file to be able to do that, but I'm not sure what the limitations are going to be. You know, like, I doubt they're going to let people do an in-kind redemption for a few hundred or a few thousand dollars. If anything, it'll probably be pretty limited to maybe institutional providers or otherwise like large whales that are worth their time trying to deal with that.
And also in the US now, there is a lot of states, I think 15 last time I checked, they actually want to use Bitcoin as a strategic reserve. Are you expecting actually A, this to happen, and B, for the entire world to say, hey, wait a second, now there is a crypto president? Because for me, there is only one Bitcoin president, that's Bukele, right? I think Trump is a crypto president. I don't know if you agree. Are you expecting something to happen at a state level where the US is going to actually start stockpiling Bitcoin?
I've said for a while that I thought that it makes more sense for individual states in the US to pursue reserves. And this is mainly, once again, from a game theory perspective. It's the same reason why other nations, especially those that don't have their own currencies, you know, like El Salvador, the nations that are essentially being subjected to the whim of the Federal Reserve, and they don't have their own monetary sovereignty. That's the same type of relationship that the states have, you know, with the feds in America. And so when you're in that situation, it makes more sense for you to pursue, you know, having an asset like Bitcoin that can give you some sovereignty. So I am more excited about that than I am about a national strategic reserve. I think that that's a really tricky thread to try to follow. You know, when you are the one that currently has like the world reserve currency, if you're coming in and saying, okay, we're also going to be adopting Bitcoin, you kind of have to be willing to say, well, we're doing this because we might be willing to disrupt ourselves over the long term. And, you know, from one perspective, that's a very forward-thinking thing, but it's also kind of like an innovator's dilemma type of problem, where when you're at the top of your game, you're at the top of the market, are you going to do everything you can to, you know, protect yourself and build a moat around whatever your product or service is? Or are you going to take a big risk and go out there and say, you know, maybe we need to be ready for the next big thing, because if we don't disrupt ourselves, somebody else is going to disrupt us.
What are you expecting, Solana? I mean, I'm not going to ask you a meme coin from Trump, because I don't think anyone was expecting it. But what are you expecting, some sort of other altcoins involved into even just into the conversation, or for you was always been Bitcoin only?
Well, like you said, Trump is the crypto president. I mean, Trump is first and foremost a businessman, right? He likes making deals. He likes negotiating. So he's not going to be hindered by some of the, more, I guess, moral aspects that people impose upon this space. So I know he's made a few references to things like, you know, American crypto tokens or whatever. And, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of that is going to come down to, you know, whoever is able to incentivize him the most to get what they want. So, yeah, I don't really hold any expectations around that. I think it's mostly going to be a battle between the you know, Bitcoin-focused people in politics and those who surround Trump versus all of the altcoiner people who, you know, have their own incentives to try to get his ear and get him to do favorable things for them.
I was in Nashville when he came in and he spoke in front of us, 50,000 people, and I mean, it's clear to me that he didn't know what Bitcoin was. I mean, RFK did, that's my opinion, a fantastic speech in regards of what Bitcoin is. But Trump, it was a pitch to 50 million people in the US. So I get it. You're fishing for votes. No judgment. But I guess the silver lining is he's appointing some interesting people around him. So I heard also Michael Saylor was kind of involved in some sort of a consultancy. Of course, Saylor doesn't have any altcoin is in his mind, so that's actually, I think it's a positive. But speaking about El Salvador, I mean, you just came back. Was it your first time there?
It had been over 3 years since I visited. I went there like right after they passed the Bitcoin law, and I went to La BitConf, which I think was the first conference that they had right after that. And so I got to observe some of the changes, and in general, it seems a lot nicer. Safer, people are optimistic, not as many armed guards standing around everywhere. You know, there still are some, but in general, it seems to be, you know, people are less on edge, and had a good time, and there were plenty of people there at the conference, and they've definitely made a number of infrastructure improvements over the past 3 years. So, you know, we'll see how that keeps going, especially with like Tether Tower and other investments that seem to be coming into the country.
Yeah, that was interesting when Tether announced a stablecoin on Bitcoin. I have no clue on how that could work, but would you be a fan of a stablecoin build on Bitcoin? What do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've already been there. I mean, Tether originally was on Bitcoin way back in the day. It's just the technology was very clunky. I would say it's kind of a pre-announcement of an announcement right now. Like, you can't actually use Tether on Lightning. As far as I'm aware, it'll probably be several months before we see the ecosystem start rolling out actual adoption in wallets and exchanges and such. But I've been pretty neutral on how Bitcoin itself is used. You know, this can be fairly controversial. You know, there was like the spam debates over the past few years. Because I'm a technologist, I see Bitcoin as a neutral platform, as kind of a authoritative record of things. That record doesn't have to only be the, you know, transfer of ownership of UTXOs and the underlying Satoshi units. It can be other things. You can, you know, anchor other systems on top of Bitcoin. And ultimately, you know, when you have a system that has even the limited amount of programmability that Bitcoin does, obviously somebody is going to do stuff with it that others consider controversial or wish didn't happen. But this is a permissionless system. So, you know, people are going to build whatever they can. They're going to experiment. And then over the long run, we'll see, you know, which technologies find product market fit and get adoption and create sustainable economic systems.
I agree. I mean, the block size, you know, inscriptions, ordinals, all those debates they, you know, we've seen in the past years, I think they're fascinating because this is my perspective. You might disagree with me or not agree with me, but Satoshi left 9 pages into a white paper. That's not much. So there is a lot of space for quote interpretation, right? So I think it should be some sort of a, I don't want to say democracy because I hate that word, but
yeah, it's not democracy, but Satoshi had a few quotes about this type of thing. Some people like to quote Satoshi saying that, you know, upon its initial release, the core design of Bitcoin was set in stone. And that's somewhat true, but I mean, that's mainly the game theory of the system was set in stone. Satoshi also had several quotes basically saying that, look, You know, there will probably be bugs, and the bugs can be fixed if we agree on how to fix them. And, you know, there is room for building other functionality and extending the system's capabilities. And if we agree on a certain path of how to do that, then once again, we can evolve the protocol. So I think Satoshi was obviously like open-minded experimenter. I think they even talked about other systems like Namecoin, for example, you know, trying to, you know, recreate the DNS system in a more decentralized way. So Satoshi was a technologist, and I don't think that Satoshi would be against people experimenting with this type of technology to see what it's capable of doing.
A lot of people are asking me about quantum computers and, you know, what Bitcoin is going to do, because the seed phrase is going to be cracked and all the money is going to be lost, and Satoshi's wallet with 5% of the supply of 1 million Bitcoin is going to be lost forever. So what's your view here? I mean, are we in danger with the quantum computers?
Yes and no. It's mainly an issue of time. And so I guess the easiest way for me to try to describe the issue is that I actually think there's a lot of similarities between the quantum computing threat to Bitcoin and like climate change, global climate change issue. So the reason that there's similarities is that in both cases, we can see trends. You know, like we can see long-term trends where the Earth is like slowly getting warmer over decades and centuries. We can see long-term trends in the quantum computing space that the computing power and capabilities of quantum are increasing fairly quickly. Now, in both of these cases, we're nowhere at like a critical point where people are dying or systems are failing. And the reason why this is so controversial is that we don't really know, is it 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, 50 years, 100 years? Like, you know, when is it a critical problem? And so because we don't know that specific point, it's hard to work backwards from that and say, okay, we need to start addressing it by blah. The way that I've been looking at it is, well, it's very difficult to change Bitcoin. Like, it tends to take many years to make significant changes to Bitcoin. There is actually reason to believe that we may be past the point at which it's possible to make significant changes to Bitcoin. And so I think that, you know, since we are relatively sure that on a long enough time frame this is going to become a problem, we might as well start working on solutions for it now. We need to get ahead of the curve. We need to have, you know, a solution decided upon so that we can roll it out and people can start to migrate their coins. Because like, even once we get all the way to a point where a quantum resistant signature scheme is agreed upon, it will then still take many years for all of the ecosystem to upgrade and many years for everyone to move their coins. That's the really tricky part. I did a number of calculations, sort of back of the napkin math, that, you know, it would probably take a couple of years worth of block space for everyone to move their coins, you know, to a new quantum resistant scheme. And of course, that's assuming that, you know, everybody is even aware of it and is, you know, trying to move their coins, and nobody else is trying to do anything else on the Bitcoin network. So it's a long-term issue, and I don't think that we have to worry about the system failing anytime in the next few years, but we should start preparing for it so that we don't find ourselves in a crisis, you know, 10 years from now. You know, is quantum computing going to break Bitcoin in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? We're not sure, but what we do know is that a number of like standards organizations and government like security organizations are basically telling companies that they should start being quantum ready in the next 5 to 10 years.
And what's your view on altcoins? I mean, do you support them? Do you have any?
Well, like I said, I'm a technologist and I'm interested in trying new things. So, I mean, I've played around with alternative cryptocurrencies basically since the beginning, since I was into Bitcoin, because I wanted to understand, you know, how is this thing any different than Bitcoin? And is it worth, the marketing hype? And so, you know, in the very early days, 13, 14 years ago, all of the altcoins were just copy paste, essentially, of the Bitcoin core software, and with a few minor tweaks, usually around things like block time or hashing algorithm or what have you. And so back then, they really weren't that interesting. But around, 2015, really when Ethereum came out, that was one of the biggest, very different systems. And of course, that kind of created a whole new ecosystem that spawned all types of stuff. And since then, we've just seen a huge proliferation. You can't even keep up with all of them anymore. So for me, I don't approach any of this stuff from an investment perspective, because really what I found is that, I can try to evaluate systems from a technical perspective, but that rarely has anything to do with how well it performs as an investment. Investment side of things tends to be more psychological and sort of based upon the marketing of the organization behind a given token. So that is not my wheelhouse, and I don't pretend to be an expert in that. But the result is that, the things that I'm more interested in tend to be privacy. So if there's a network that comes out that says, we have greatly improved privacy, then, I'm more likely to look into that and try to understand it and see, is this a tool I can leverage to benefit me? Other than that, a lot of the stuff that's out there these days is really more catered to the sort of degen, DeFi, get rich quick aspect of this space, and I'm not really into that, so I don't pay too much attention to it. But I do think it's interesting that I think the number of crypto tokens has basically gone exponential over the past year, and the Bitcoin dominance has actually remained quite high regardless of that. So if anything, I think it's really showing more and more differentiation between Bitcoin and the rest of the market, because there's something like 30 or 40 million different crypto tokens now, and yet you have Bitcoin still retaining the majority of market share, despite the market itself really getting more and more diluted.
It's such a good point. I also check dominance quite often, and I can see, like you said, there is holding steady, right? So that's why some people are saying, oh, this cycle, we won't see any altcoin season, because what we've seen so far is like a Christmas tree, as I call it. Bitcoin goes up, and then after you have the coin, because people take profit into coins, maybe of different reasons, but you have a kind of a money circulation into altcoins. And do you believe, by the way, we are still in a four-year cycle, and we will stay in a four-year cycle now that we have nations and ETFs and different players playing the game? So are you expecting for us to technically top up this year or maybe next year, or you think we can go into the super cycle, so-called?
I mean, the problem is no one really knows why we have these four-year cycles. Is it the halving? I mean, maybe that contributes a little bit. Is it the fact that it's like lined up with presidential cycles? Maybe. I don't know. It may just be, The larger like national and global markets also have business cycles. And so it may just be that like this is the crypto business cycle, whatever that may be. We may not fully understand like all of the variables that go into that. But I have been surprised every time that the cycle repeats, because I very similar to what you're saying is like, if everybody is expecting something to happen, then from a sort of market dynamics and trading perspective, then folks should start front running it, right? And essentially someone should be trying to take advantage of that, and if too many people try to do that, then that should break the cycle and break up whatever the pattern is. So I've, like I said, I've been surprised the past couple of cycles that it keeps repeating. Three annual green candles, one red candle, keep going. So I have no reason to believe that it's any different this time, because last cycle people said this time is different, and they were very wrong then. I think the biggest tricky thing for me now is that, whenever people are predicting the future, especially of like what the price of Bitcoin is going to be, it's like the stronger the consensus is that it's going to be something, I feel like the more likely that's not what's going to happen. So it's like, how do you be contrarian to that? I don't know.
Everyone was expecting 100,000 in the previous cycle, right? I mean, everyone, myself included. I'm not gonna lie, I was expecting at least 100,000, and we topped up 70, not even, in some exchanges. So this time, I don't know what's gonna happen. And yeah, like you said, every time we say this is different, and they kind of rhyme. It's not always the same per se, but there is a lot of similarities. Like you said, the three green candles and one red candle. So, and we all know that Bitcoin likes to do what Bitcoin likes to do. So definitely going to be an interesting one. That's why I think timing the market could be extremely challenging. Do you play the cycle at all? Do you have a portion of your portfolio you strategically sell when we catch some points, or you just ride and hodl?
I never have. I was planning on doing that last cycle, but I wasn't planning on selling anything under 100K. So, we never hit it.
Same, by the way.
I may take some off the top this cycle. We also discuss internally, of course, our own Bitcoin treasury management strategies at our company. How do we try to maximize our runway and take advantage of volatility? We're not really active traders at the company either, but simply because we accept Bitcoin for payment, we build up a decent treasury over the years. And thankfully, I did convince people at the company that we should buy a bunch during the last dip when it got around like 20K or so. So, that's the only real trading, I guess, that we've done. And I feel like I'm a terrible trader, but I'm always decent at buying the dip. Like I'm pretty good at getting a feel for, when there's blood in the streets and everybody says it's all over. But I've never been good at understanding like where the top is, where peak FOMO is, because it seems like it usually goes further than I expect, except last cycle where it, stopped well short of what we expect. So, I kind of figure, trying to predict the future is a fool's errand, but I think there are a couple of different sort of management strategies that you can undertake. If you've been in Bitcoin for a few cycles, if the vast majority of net worth is in Bitcoin and you want to take a little bit off the top. I've got on my website the Bitcoin savings plan calculator. I've seen a few other calculators out there that are based on other models like Power Law and whatever. I don't believe in any of the models. I think models are basically made to be broken. But I think that it may make sense if you're basically 100% into Bitcoin to have some strategy to take a few percent out. You never want to sell all of your Bitcoin, or you're probably going to regret it. But take a few percent out and improve your quality of life, whatever that may be. The never sell your Bitcoin crowd does kind of annoy me because, well, it depends on how you interpret that, right? I think the reason why I got into Bitcoin at the very beginning is really as a long-term hedge against fiat going down. So for me, it wasn't about getting rich quick. It was about not getting poor over a long period of time. So it's just wealth preservation. And the purpose of wealth is to use it to improve your life to improve other people's lives. You know, if you're just sitting on it forever, then you know, you're probably not making great use of it. You know, some other people talk about, well, you never sell your Bitcoin, you only like borrow against it. And I still feel like a lot of the solutions that we have for that aren't great. You know, a lot of people have definitely gotten burned by lending out their coins over the years. I think we do have a few improvements. Like there are some systems out there like Lava that's built on discrete log contracts that show more promise, but they haven't really been around long enough to, I think, have built up enough of a reputation that, you know, they don't have any unforeseen edge cases that could fail.
I'm so glad you, by the way, you touched on the topic, because it drives me nuts. Like, I have everything I have is in Bitcoin. I'm getting paid in Bitcoin. How am I supposed to be living my life? And I'm not talking about buying Rolexes and Lamborghinis, just paying rent. Like, I have to sell Bitcoin. Yeah. Of course, I don't want to do it. But if you are plugged in, like you said, it's such a situationship, you know. Of course, if you have a job, you're getting paid in fiat and you save into Bitcoin. Yeah, great. Don't sell it. But even though at some point, you'll have to consider it. Otherwise, if this asset nobody sell it, well, then there's no use for it. Like, it has to circulate, right? Otherwise, what's the point?
I've told some people, like, the main reason that I still have a salary is just so that I can reduce my need to sell Bitcoin. But that's you know, it won't be that way forever. And if I think back on over like the past 4 or 5 years, where I guess you could say I've sold more Bitcoin. I haven't sold it to, you know, buy Lambos or other stuff for myself. I've mostly sold it to actually invest in Bitcoin companies, or I've donated it to charities, preferably those that have like developer grant programs. So, you know, most of the time when I'm like, disposing of Bitcoin for one reason or another, it's actually to put it back into the system, kind of, you know, give back to this thing that has done so well for me.
I agree. And there is a karmatic element to it. If you get rid of it, per se, if you exchange it into fiat or whatever, into assets, you're allowing someone else to pick it up. So I think there is a karmatic element. It's not like a coin that when you sell it, you basically want to exit. Actually, you are offering someone else a chance to, you know, buy some Satoshis, which are indeed very limited. So I think there is a karmatic element in there that I also like. And I wanted to ask you, I mean, what's the first problem you see when it comes to self-custody? Is the UX, is the fact that people don't understand how to store it, is the fact that they don't know they can self-custody? What's the barrier from users to self-custody their Bitcoin?
The biggest initial barrier is kind of how people get onboarded. So the vast majority, at least in Western world, get onboarded through, you know, some regulated entity, whether that's a crypto exchange like Bitcoin, like Coinbase or Kraken or what have you, or now through the ETFs. And so then this is one reason why the ETFs are concerning. Now, you know, people get onboarded through the ETFs. That's it. They're stuck. You know, there is no withdrawal, at least as of today. And I doubt there will be for like retail level people. If you're getting into one of the, you know, older crypto exchanges, most of the time people are just buying and then they're just letting it sit there and that's it. And in some cases, this may be because they simply don't know that withdrawing is an option, because, you know, if you're a sort of TradFi investor, then that's just not a normal flow, right? You go to your broker, you buy stuff, and you're done. You don't like transfer it to other brokers. It's a pretty rare thing to do. So a lot of people probably don't even think about it. Or, you know, if they are aware that that's an option, then they just don't want to deal with the responsibility, or you know, they're afraid they're going to screw it up. And, you know, in a way, that's an accurate fear to have. That's like, once you withdraw to self-custody, you are taking on a lot of responsibility. There are things that you can do that will basically cause you to lose your money forever. So, you know, that's why I've been focused on improving self-custody for a decade now, is that I think that if it's not easy, if it's not something that people can get comfortable with, then of course they're not going to do it. They're just going to leave their Bitcoin with a trusted third party. And, you know, I see that as antithetical to like the entire reason that this space exists. So, like I said, it's kind of like an ongoing war between the convenience of trusted third parties and the responsibility, but the potential empowerment that can come with self-custody. So, you know, when I decided to switch my career a decade ago, I decided that I wanted to have like a mission, and my mission wasn't Bitcoin. Rather, I decided that I wanted my mission to be to use my skills as a technologist to help empower individuals. So, you know, that can mean a number of different things, but I feel like, you know, Bitcoin and self-custody is one of the highest value, most direct ways to do that. And, you know, thanks to, you know, cryptography and software in general, there are a number of different tools and things that you can do out there to empower yourself and, you know, protect yourself from the man or trusted third parties or what have you. But, you know, doing that with your finances, I think the financial aspect is one of the most long-term empowering things, because of course, if you have, you know, sovereign wealth, that just opens up a lot of other opportunities for you over the long term.
It sounds really complicated to explain to someone that you guys can help with self-custody, because the first thing people are going to think about is like, wait, so am I losing then my Bitcoin? Do you have an onboarding where you kind of explain the process to new clients?
Yeah, and you know, we have several different tiers, all the way from a basically $250 a year, you know, $20 a month annualized, mostly do-it-yourself setup, where you get email support from us. And, you know, we provide you with the mobile app, which is your primary guidance for, you know, how do you set up and maintain your key set to your funds. And then at higher level tiers, what you're really paying for with us is higher level of consultation, because ultimately there's a lot of decisions that go into, you know, creating your own bank and figuring out the security of, you know, how you're storing and distributing and accessing the keys. And the primary thing that we're trying to help people do here is to create a setup that eliminates single points of failure. Because we have to understand that people are human, people make mistakes, things go wrong. You know, there can be catastrophes, whether that's like house fire or other natural disasters, or there can be, you know, issues with software and hardware and, you know, a million different types of attacks or just failures that over a long period of time can tend to happen. So, you know, you want your setup to be resilient and robust enough that when those failures happen, it does not result in catastrophic loss of funds. And you know, the way that we achieve that is by using, you know, multi-sig, or another way of saying it is multiple keys that are used to access your funds. So think of it as, if you're a Harry Potter fan, it's kind of like a Horcrux, right? If you want to access the great power within, we say, you know, you have to have a threshold of pieces of these keys, and you distribute them geographically and on different software, different hardware, and basically think about everything that could go wrong, and then put you into a system where when any given thing does go wrong, it should only affect one key. And then you can use your other keys to effectively recover from that and, you know, heal your setup and continue moving forward. It's like a more dynamic management system, I think, for your vault, if you want to think of it that way. I think one problem a lot of people tend to fall into in this space is they're like, okay, I set up my cold storage. I set it up and then I bury it and I forget about it for 10 years, right? Well, there's a number of things that can go wrong during that period, why I think that you should not just forget about it for a long period of time. And so, you know, we're believers in more active management and sort of active checking that your security is healthy and has not degraded over time.
Do you recommend, for example, for whoever is storing their Bitcoin into a Trezor or Ledger to update the firmware?
If it's a security update, then I think it's a good idea. If it's just an update where they're like adding more crypto tokens, then you may not care about that. You know, whenever you're doing those firmware updates, you definitely want to be sure that you have your seed phrase backup, because we've seen no shortage of times when doing firmware updates has wiped devices.
100%. And this is another issue, by the way, which is where do you store it? How do you keep it? Which is a completely different chapter, right? That's why Casa HODL. Guys, again, in the description, you will find Jameson link and, of course, Casa HODL, because I strongly recommend to look into it. It's good to at least explore different paths to make sure that you save your Bitcoin in the most safe and secure way possible. So, well, Jameson, thank you so much, man. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Really appreciate you coming in and sharing your knowledge with us. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
Guys, thank you so much for watching. I will see you on the next one.